There's a clear pecking order in the gang, and his associates are often afraid of him. He's violent, frequently high, and he beats the shit out of anyone who steps out of line. Salander's furniture from IKEA was delivered at 9:30 in the morning 3 days later. Two extremely robust citizens shook hands with blonde Irene Nesser, who spoke with a sprightly Norwegian accent. They began at once shuttling the boxes up to the apartment in the undersized elevator and spent the day assembling tables, cabinets, and beds. Irene Nesser went down to Surahalarna Market to buy Greek takeout for their lunch. The men from IKEA were gone by mid-afternoon. Salander took off her wig and strolled around her apartment, wondering how she was going to like living in her new home. The kitchen table looked too elegant to be true. The room next to the kitchen, with doors from both the hall and the kitchen, was her new living room, with modern sofas and armchairs around a coffee table by the window. She was pleased with the bedroom and sat down tentatively on the Hemnes bedstead to test the mattress. She sat at the desk in her office, enjoying the view of Sadsjön.
Yes, this is a good setup. I can work here.
What she was going to work on, though, she didn't know. Salander spent the rest of the evening unpacking and arranging her belongings. She made the bed and put the towels, sheets, and pillowcases in the linen closet. She opened the bags of new clothes and hung them in the closets. In spite of all she had bought, it filled only a fraction of the space. She put the lamps in place and arranged the pots and pans, the crockery and the cutlery in the kitchen cupboards and drawers. She looked critically at the empty walls and realized that she was going to have to find some posters or pictures. A vase for flowers wouldn't hurt either. Then she opened her cardboard boxes from Lundergarten and put away books, magazines, clippings, and old research papers that she probably should have thrown away. Without any regret, she discarded her old T-shirts and socks with holes in them. Suddenly she found a dildo, still in its original box. She smiled wryly. It had been one of those freaky birthday presents from Mimi. She had entirely forgotten that she had it and had never even tried it. She decided to rectify that situation and set the dildo on her bedside table. Then she became serious.
Mimi.
She felt a pang of guilt. She had been with Mimi fairly regularly for a year and then left her for Blomqvist without a word of explanation. She had not said goodbye or told her she was thinking of leaving the country. Nor had she said goodbye to Armansky or told the girls in Evil Fingers anything at all. They must think she was dead. Or else they had simply forgotten about her. She had never been a central figure in the group. She realized at that moment that she had not said goodbye to George Bland on Grenada, either. And she wondered whether he was walking on the beach, looking for her. She remembered what Blomqvist had told her about friendship being based on respect and trust.
I keep squandering my friends.
She wondered whether Mimi was still around, whether she should try to get in touch with her. She spent most of the evening and a good part of the night sorting papers in her office, installing her computers and surfing the net. She did a swift check of her investments and found that she was better off than she had been a year earlier. She did a routine check of Bjurman's computer but found nothing in his correspondence that gave her reason to think that he was not towing the line. He seemed to have scaled back his professional and private activities to a semi-vegetative state. He seldom used email, and when he surfed the internet he mostly went on porn sites. She did not log off until around 2 in the morning. She went into the bedroom and undressed, flinging her clothes over a chair. In the bathroom mirror she looked at herself for a long time, examining her angular, asymmetrical face, her new breasts, and the tattoo on her back. It was beautiful, a curving dragon in red, green, and black. During the year of her travels, she had let her hair grow to shoulder length, but at the end of her stay on Grenada she had taken a pair of scissors to it. It still stuck out in all directions. She felt that some fundamental change had taken place, or was taking place, in her life. Maybe it was having access to billions of kroner and not having to think about every kroner she spent. Maybe it was the adult world which was belatedly pushing its way into her life. Maybe it was the realization that, with her mother's death, her childhood had come to an end. During the operation on her breasts at the clinic in Genoa, a ring in her nipple had to be removed. Then she had done away with a ring from her lower lip, and on Grenada she had taken the ring out of her left labium. It had chafed, and she had no idea why she had let herself be pierced there in the first place. She yawned and unscrewed the stud she had had through her tongue for 7 years. She put it in a bowl on the shelf next to the sink. Her mouth felt empty. Apart from the rings in her earlobes, she had now only 2 piercings left, a ring in her left eyebrow and a jewel in her navel. At last she crept under her new duvet. The bed she had bought was gigantic. She felt as if she were lying on the edge of a soccer field. She pulled the duvet around her and thought for a long time. Chapter 6. Sunday, January 23rd, to Saturday, January 29th. Sarinda took the elevator from the garage to the third floor, the uppermost floor occupied by Milton Security in the office building near Slussen. She opened the elevator door with a card key that she had pirated several years earlier. She automatically glanced at her watch as she stepped into the unlit corridor. Sunday, 3:10 a.m. The night watchman would be sitting at the alarm station on the second floor, a long way from the elevator shaft, and she knew that she would almost certainly have this floor to herself. She was, as always, astonished that a security company had such basic lapses in its own operations. Not much had changed on the third floor in the year that had passed. She began by visiting her old office. A cubicle behind a glass wall in the corridor where Armansky had installed her. The door was unlocked. Absolutely nothing had changed, except that someone had set a cardboard box of waste paper inside the door. The desk, the office chair, the waste paper basket, one empty bookshelf, and an obsolete Dell PC with a pitifully small hard drive. Sarinda could see nothing to suggest that Armansky had turned the room over to anyone else. She took this as a good sign, but she knew that it did not mean much. It was space that could hardly be put to any sensible use. Sarinda closed the door and strolled the length of the corridor, making sure that there was no night owl in any of the offices. She stopped at the coffee machine and pressed the button for a cup of cappuccino, then opened the door to Armansky's office with her pirated card key. His office was, as always, irritatingly tidy. She made a brisk tour of inspection and studied the bookshelf before sitting down at his desk and switching on his computer. She fished out a CD from the inside pocket of her jacket and pushed it into the hard drive, then started a program called Asphyxia 1.3. She had written it herself, and its only function was to upgrade Internet Explorer on Armansky's computer to a more modern version. The procedure took about 5 minutes. When she was done, she ejected the CD and rebooted the computer with a new version of Internet Explorer. The program looked and behaved exactly like the original version, but it was a tiny bit larger, and a microsecond slower. All installations were identical to the original, including the install date. There would be no trace of the new file. She typed in an FTP address for a server in Holland and got a command screen. She clicked Copy, wrote the name Armansky/Miltsec, and clicked OK. The computer instantly began copying Armansky's hard drive to the server in Holland. A clock indicated that the process would take 34 minutes. While the transfer was in progress, she took the spare key to Armansky's desk from a pot on the bookshelf and spent the next half hour bringing herself up to date on the files Armansky kept in his top right-hand desk drawer, his crucial current jobs. When the computer dinged as a sign that the transfer was complete, she put the files back in the order that she had found them. Then she shut down the computer and switched off the desk lamp, taking the empty cappuccino cup with her. She left the Milton Security Building the same way she had come. It was 4:12 a.m. She walked home and sat down at her powerbook and logged on to the server in Holland, where she started a copy of Asphyxia 1.3. A window opened asking for the name of the hard drive. She had 40 different options and scrolled down. She passed the hard drive for Nils E. Bjurman, which she usually glanced through every other month. She paused for a second at Meek Blom/laptop and Meek Blom/office. She had not clicked on those icons for more than a year, and she wondered vaguely whether to delete them. But she then decided, as a matter of principle, to hang on to them. Since she had gone to the trouble of hacking into a computer, it would be stupid to delete the information and maybe one day have to do the whole procedure all over again. The same was true for an icon called Venestrom, which she had not opened in a long time. The man of that name was dead. The icon Armansky/Miltsek, the last one created, was at the bottom of the list. She could have cloned his hard drive earlier, but she had never bothered to because she worked at Milton and could easily retrieve any information that Armansky wanted to keep hidden from the rest of the world. Her trespassing on his computer was not malicious. She just wanted to know what the computer was working on, to see the lay of the land. She clicked, and a folder immediately opened with a new icon called Armansky HD. She tried out whether she could access the hard drive and checked that all the files were in place. She read through Armansky's reports, financial statements, and email until 7 a.m. Finally, she crawled into bed and slept until 12:30 in the afternoon. On the last Friday in January, Millennium's annual board meeting took place in the presence of the company's bookkeeper, an outside auditor, and the four partners: Berger, 30%, Blomqvist, 20%, Malm, 20%, and Harriet Wanger, 30%. Erickson was there as the representative of the staff and the staff committee, and the chair of the union at the magazine. The union consisted of Erickson, Lotte Karim, Cortez, Nielsen, and marketing chief Sonny Magnusson. It was Erickson's first board meeting. The meeting began at 4 and lasted an hour. Much of the time was spent on the financials and the audit report. Clearly Millennium was on a solid footing, very different from the crisis in which the company had been mired 2 years earlier. The auditors reported a profit of 2.1 million kroner, of which roughly 1 million was down to Blomqvist's book about the Wennerström affair. Berger proposed, and it was agreed, that 1 million be set aside as a fund against future crises, that 250,000 kroner be reserved for capital investments, such as new computers and other equipment, and repairs at the editorial offices, and that 300,000 kroner be earmarked for salary increases and to allow them to offer Cortez a full-time contract. Of the balance, a dividend of 50,000 kroner was proposed for each partner, and 100,000 kroner to be divided equally among the four employees, regardless of whether they worked full or part-time. Magnusson was to receive no bonus. His contract gave him a commission on the ads he sold, and periodically these made him the highest paid of all the staff. These proposals were adopted unanimously. Blomqvist proposed that the freelance budget be reduced in favour of an additional part-time reporter. Blomqvist had Svensson in mind. He would then be able to use Millennium as a base for his freelance writing, and later, if it all worked out, be hired full-time. The proposal met with resistance from Berger, on the grounds that the magazine could not thrive without access to a large number of freelance articles. She was supported by Harriet Wanger. Malm abstained. It was decided that the freelance budget would not be touched, but it would be investigated whether adjustments of other expenses might be made. Everyone wanted Svensson on the staff, at the very least as a part-time contributor. There followed a brief discussion about future direction and development plans. Berger was re-elected as chair of the board for the coming year, and then the meeting was adjourned. Erickson had said not a word. She was content at the prospect that she and her colleagues would get a bonus of 25,000 kroner, more than a month's salary. At the close of the board meeting, Berger called for a partners' meeting. Berger, Blomqvist, Malm, and Harriet Wanger remained, while the others left the conference room. Berger declared the meeting open.
"There is only one item on the agenda," she said. "Harriet, according to the agreement we made with Henrik, his part ownership was to last for 2 years. The agreement is about to expire. We have to decide what is going to happen with your, or rather Henrik's, interest in Millennium." "We all know that my uncle's investment was an impulsive gesture, triggered by a most unusual situation," Harriet said. "That situation no longer exists. What do you propose?"
Malm squirmed with annoyance. He was the only one in the room who did not know what that unusual situation was. Blomqvist and Berger had to keep the story from him. Berger had told him only that it was a matter so personal, involving Blomqvist, that he would never under any circumstances discuss it. Malm was smart enough to realize that Blomqvist's silence had something to do with Hedestad and Harriet Wanger. He also knew that he didn't need all the details to be able to make a decision, and he had enough respect for Blomqvist not to make an issue of it.
"The three of us have discussed the matter, and we have arrived at a decision," Berger said. She looked Harriet in the eye. "But before we explain our reasoning, We would like to know what you think.
Harriet Wanger glanced at them in turn. Her gaze lingered on Blomqvist, but she could not read anything from their expressions.
If you want to buy the family out, it will cost around 3 million kroner plus interest. Can you afford to buy us out? She asked mildly.
Yes, we can, Blomqvist said with a smile. He had been paid 5 million kroner by Henrik Wanger for the work he had done for the old industrial tycoon. Part of that work, ironically, had been to find out what had happened to Harriet, his niece.
In that case, the decision is in your hands, Harriet said. The agreement stipulates that you can cancel the Wanger shareholding as of today. I would never have written a contract as sloppy as the one Henrik signed.
We can buy you out if we have to, Berger said. But the real question is what you want to do. You're the CEO of a substantial industrial concern. Two concerns, actually. Our annual budget might correspond to what you turn over during a coffee break. Why would you give your time to a business as marginal as Millennium?
Harriet Wanger looked calmly at the chair of the board, saying nothing for a long moment. Then she turned to Blomqvist and replied,
I've been the owner of something or other since the day I was born, and I spend my days running a corporation that has more intrigues than a 400-page romance novel. When I first joined your board, it was to fulfill obligations that I could not neglect. But you know what? During the past 18 months, I've realized that I'm having more fun on this board than on all the others put together.
Blomqvist absorbed this thoughtfully. Wanger now turned to Malm.
The problems you face at Millennium are small and manageable. Naturally, the company wants to operate at a profit, that's a given. But all of you have another goal. You want to achieve something.
She took a sip from her glass of water and fixed her eyes on Berger.
Exactly what that something is remains a bit unclear to me. The objective is hazy. You aren't a political party or a special interest group. You have no loyalties to consider except your own, but you pinpoint flaws in society, and you don't mind entering into battles with public figures. Often you want to change things and make a real difference. You all pretend to be cynics and nihilists, but it's your own morality that steers the magazine, and several times I've noticed that it's quite a special sort of morality. I don't know what to call it, except to say that Millennium has a soul. This is the only board I'm proud to be a part of.
She fell silent for so long that Berger had to laugh.
That sounds good, but you still haven't answered the question. This has been some of the wackiest, most absurd stuff I've ever been involved with. But I enjoy your company, and I've had a great time. If you want me to stay on, I gladly will.
Okay, Malm said. We've been back and forth, and we're all agreed. We'll buy you out.
Wanger's eyes widened.
You want to get rid of me?
When we signed the contract, we had our heads on the block waiting for the axe. We had no choice. From the start, we were counting the days until we could buy out your uncle.
Berger opened a file, laid some papers on the table and pushed them over to Wanger, together with a cheque for exactly the sum due. Wanger read through the papers, and without a word she signed them.
All right, then, Berger said. That was fairly painless. I want to put on record our gratitude to Henrik Wanger for all he did for Millennium. I hope you will convey this to him.
I will,
Harriet Wanger said in a neutral tone, betraying nothing of what she felt. She was both hurt and deeply disappointed that they had let her say that she wanted to stay, and then had simply kicked her out.
And now let me see if I can interest you in a completely different contract, Berger said.
She took out another set of papers and slid them across the table.
We were wondering if you personally had any interest in becoming a partner at Millennium. The price would be the same as the sum you've just received. The agreement has no time limits or exception clauses. You would be a full partner with the same responsibilities as the rest of us.
Wanger raised her eyebrows.
Why this roundabout process? It had to be done sooner or later, Malm said. We could have renewed the old agreement a year at a time, or until the board had an argument and put you out, but it was always a contract that would have to be dissolved.
Harriet leaned on her elbow and gave him a searching glance. She looked at Blomqvist and then at Berger.
We signed our agreement with Henrik
when we were in financial straits, Berger said. We're offering you this agreement because we want to, and unlike the old one, it won't let us boot you out so easily in the future.
That's a very big difference for us, Blomqvist said in a low voice, and that was his only contribution to the discussion.
The fact is that we believe you add something to Millennium, besides the financial underpinning implied by the name of Wanger, Berger said. You're smart and sensible, and you come up with constructive solutions. Until now you've kept a low profile, almost like a guest visiting us once a quarter, but you represent for this board a stability and direction that we've never had before. You know the business. Once you asked if you could trust me, and I wondered the same thing about you. By now we both know the answer. I like you, and I trust you. We all do. We don't want you to be a part of us by way of some complicated legal mumbo-jumbo. We want you as a partner and a real shareholder.
Harriet reached for the contract and spent 5 minutes reading through it. Finally she looked up.
And all three of you are agreed, she said.
Three heads nodded. Wanger lifted her pen and signed. She shoved the check back across the table, and Blomqvist tore it up. The partners of Millennium had dinner together at Samir's Cauldron on Tavastgarten. It was a quiet party, to celebrate the new arrangement, with good wine and couscous with lamb. The conversation was relaxed, and Wanger was noticeably dazed. It felt a little like an uncomfortable first date. Something was going to happen, but no one knows exactly what it might be. Wanger had to leave at 7:30. She excused herself by saying that she had to go to her hotel and get an early night. Berger was heading home to her husband and walked with her some of the way. They parted at Slusen. Blomqvist and Malm stayed on for a while before Malm excused himself and said that he too had to get home. Wanger took a taxi to the Sheraton and went straight to her room on the 8th floor. She got undressed and had a bath and put on the hotel's robe. Then she sat at the window and looked out towards Riddarholmen. She took a pack of Dunhills from her bag. She smoked 3 or 4 cigarettes a day, so few that she could consider herself a non-smoker and still enjoy it without a guilty conscience. At 9 there was a knock at the door. She opened it and let Blomqvist in.
"You scoundrel," she said.
He smiled and gave her a kiss on the cheek.
"I really thought you guys were going to kick me out."
"We never would have done it like that.
Do you understand why we wanted to rewrite the contract?"
"Of course. It makes perfect sense."
Blomqvist opened her robe and put a hand on her breast, caressing it cautiously.
"You scoundrel," she said again.
Salander stopped at the door with a nameplate that said, "Woo." She had seen a light from the street, and now she could hear music coming from inside. So Miriam Wu still lived here, in the studio apartment on Tomtebogarten, near St. Eriksplan. It was Friday evening, and Salander had half hoped that Mimi would be out having fun somewhere. The only question that remained to be answered were whether Mimi still wanted to have anything to do with her, and whether she was alone and available. She rang the bell. Mimi opened the door, and her eyebrows lifted in surprise. Then she leaned against the door jamb and put her hand on her hip.
"Salander, I thought you were dead or something."
"Or something.
What do you want?"
"There are many answers to that question."
Miriam Wu looked around the stairwell before she again fixed her eyes on Salander.
"Try one."
"Well, I just wanted to see whether you're still single and might want some company tonight."
Mimi looked astonished for a few seconds and then laughed out loud.
"I know only one person who would ever dream of ringing my bell after a year and a half's silence to ask me if I wanted to fuck.
Do you want me to leave?"
Mimi stopped laughing. She was quiet for a few seconds.
"Lisbeth." "Jesus, you're serious."
Salander waited. Finally, Mimi sighed and opened the door wide.
"Come on, then. I can at least offer you a coffee."
Salander followed her in and sat on one of 2 stools by a small table in the hall. The apartment was about 250 square feet, 1 cramped room and a hall. The kitchen was little more than a niche for cooking in a corner of the hall. Mimi had fixed a hose to the sink from the bathroom. Mimi's mother was from Hong Kong, her father from Boden. Salander knew that her parents lived in Paris. Mimi was studying sociology in Stockholm and she had an older sister studying anthropology in the States. Her mother's genes were visible in Mimi's raven black hair, cut short, and her slightly Asian features. Her father had given her the clear blue eyes. She had a wide mouth and dimples that did not come from either of her parents. Mimi was 31. She liked to dress up in leather and go to clubs where they did performance art. Sometimes she appeared in the shows. Salander had not been to a club since she was 16. Besides her studies, Mimi had a job one day a week as a sales clerk at Domino Fashion on a street off Sveavägen. Customers, desperate for outfits such as a rubber nurse's uniform or black leather witch's garb, frequented Domino, which both designed and manufactured the clothes. Mimi was part owner of the boutique with some girlfriends, and the shop provided a modest supplement to her student loan of a few thousand kroner each month. Salander had first seen Mimi when she performed in a show at the Gay Pride Festival a couple of years before, and then ran into her in a beer tent later that night. Mimi had been dressed in an odd lemon-yellow plastic dress that revealed more than it concealed. Salander saw nothing erotic about the outfit, but she had been drunk enough to suddenly want to pick up a girl dressed like a lemon. To Salander's great surprise, the citrus fruit had taken one look at her, laughed out loud, kissed her without embarrassment, and said, "You're the one I want." They had gone back to Salander's place and had sex all night long.
"I am what I am," Salander said. "I ran away from everything and everybody. I should have said goodbye. I thought something had happened to you. Not that we had been in touch that much in the last months you were here. I was busy. You're such a mystery. You never talk about yourself. I don't even know where you work or who I could have called when you didn't answer your mobile. I'm not working anywhere right now. And besides, you're just like me. You wanted sex, but you weren't particularly interested in a relationship. Or were you?"
"That's true," Mimi said at last.
"And it was the same with me. I never made any promises."
"You've changed," Mimi said.
"Not a lot."
"You look older, more mature. You have different clothes. And you've stuffed your bra with something."
Salander said nothing. Mimi had seen her naked. Of course, she would notice the change. In the end, she lowered her eyes and mumbled,
"I had a boob job." "What did you say?"
Salander looked up and raised her voice, unaware that it had taken on a defiant tone.
"I went to a clinic in Italy and had breast implants. That's why I disappeared. Then I just kept on travelling. Now I'm back."
"Are you joking?"
Salander looked at Mimi expressionless.
"Stupid of me. You never joke about anything, Mr. Spock."
"I'm not going to apologise. I'm just being honest. If you want me to leave, just say the word."
Mimi laughed out loud.
"Well, I certainly don't want you to leave without letting me see how they look. Please?
I've always liked having sex with you, Mimi. You didn't give a damn what sort of work I did, and if I was busy, you found somebody else."
Mimi nodded. When she was 17, after a number of fumbling attempts, she was finally initiated into the mysteries of sex at a party organized in Göteborg by the Swedish Federation for Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual and Transgender Rights. She had never considered any other lifestyle after that. Once when she was 23, she had tried having sex with a man. She mechanically did everything she was expected to do, but it was not enjoyable. She also belonged to the minority within the minority, who were not interested in marriage or fidelity, or cozy evenings at home.
"I've been home for a few weeks. I needed to know if I had to go out and pick somebody up, or if you're still interested."
Mimi bent down and kissed her gently on the lips.
"I was thinking of studying tonight."
She unbuttoned the top button of Lisbeth's blouse.
"But what the hell?"
She kissed her again and kept unbuttoning.
"I just have to see this."
She kissed her again.
"Welcome back."
Harriet Wanger fell asleep around 2 a.m. Blomqvist lay awake, listening to her breathing. After a while he got up and filched a Dunhill from the pack in her handbag. He sat in a chair next to the bed and looked at her. He had not planned to become Harriet Wanger's lover. Far from it. After his time in Hedestad, he wanted more than anything to keep the whole Wanger family at arm's length. He had seen Harriet at board meetings and kept his distance. They knew each other's secrets, but apart from Harriet Wanger's role on Millennium's board, their dealings were at an end.
During the Whitsuntide vacation the year before, Blomqvist had gone to his cabin in Sandhamn for the first time in several months, to have some peace and quiet and sit on the porch and read crime novels. On the Friday afternoon, he was on his way to the kiosk to buy some cigarettes when he ran into Harriet. She had apparently felt a need to get away from Hedestad herself, and had booked a weekend at the hotel in Sandhamn. She had not been there since she was a child. She had been 16 when she left Sweden, and 53 when she came back. It was Blomqvist who had tracked her down. After their surprised greetings, Harriet had lapsed into an awkward silence. Blomqvist knew her history, and she was aware that he had compromised his principles in order to cover up the Wanger family's horrific secrets, and in part he had done it for her. Blomqvist invited her to his cabin. He made coffee, and they sat on the porch outside for several hours, talking. It was the first time they had talked at length since her return. Blomqvist could not resist asking, "What did you do with the stuff in Martin's basement?"
"Do you really want to know?"
"Yes.
I cleaned it up myself. I burned everything that would burn. I had the house torn down. I couldn't live there, and I couldn't sell it and let someone else live there. For me, all its associations were with evil. I'm planning another house to take its place, a small cabin."
"Didn't people raise their eyebrows when you had the house torn down? It was quite luxurious and modern." She smiled.
"Dirk Frode put about the story that there was so much damp in the foundation that it would be more expensive to rebuild than to take it down."
Frode was the family's lawyer. "How is Frode getting on?"
"He's going to be 70 soon. I'm keeping him busy."
They had lunch together, and Blomqvist realized that Harriet Wanger was sitting there telling him the most intimate and private details about her life. When he asked her why, she thought for a moment and said that there really was no one else in the whole world with whom she could be so open. Besides, it was hard not to open her heart to a kid she had babysat all of 40 years ago. She had had sex with 3 men in her life. First her father, and then her brother. She had killed her father and run away from her brother. Somehow she had survived and met a man with whom she had created a new life for herself.
"He was tender and loving, dependable and honest. I was happy with him. We had a wonderful 20 years together before he became ill."
"You never remarried?" "Why not?"
She shrugged. "I was the mother of 2 children in Australia, and the owner of a big agricultural business. I could never get away for a romantic weekend. And I've never missed sex."
They sat quiet for a while.
"It's late. I should be getting back to the hotel."
Blomqvist made no move to get up.
"Do you want to seduce me?"
"I do," he said. He stood up and took her hand, leading her into the cabin and up to the sleeping loft. Suddenly she stopped him.
"I don't really know how. This is not something I do every day."
They spent the whole weekend together, and then one night every 3 months after the magazine's board meetings. It was not a relationship that could be sustained. She worked around the clock and was very often travelling, and every other month she was in Australia. But she had come to value her occasional rendezvous with Blomqvist. Mimi made coffee 2 hours later as Salander lay naked and sweaty on top of the bedclothes. She smoked a cigarette and watched Mimi through the doorway. She envied Mimi's body. She was impressively muscled. She worked out at a gym 3 evenings a week, one of them doing Thai boxing, or some sort of karate shit, and this had given her body an awesome shape. She was just delicious. Not beautiful like a model, but genuinely attractive. She loved to provoke and flirt. When she dressed up for a party, she could get anyone whatsoever interested in her. Salander did not understand why Mimi cared about a goose like her. But she was glad she did. Sex with Mimi was so dramatically liberating that Salander just relaxed and enjoyed it, taking what she wanted for herself and giving in return. Mimi came back and put 2 mugs on a stool beside the bed. She crawled onto the bed and leaned over to nibble at one of Salander's nipples.
"They'll do," she said.
Salander said nothing. She looked at Mimi's breasts. Mimi's breasts were small, too, but they looked completely natural on her body.
If I'm going to be honest, Lisbeth, you look fantastic.
That's silly. My breasts don't really make any difference one way or the other, but at least I've got some now.
You're so hung up about your body.
You're one to talk, working out like an idiot.
I work out like an idiot because I like to work out.
It's a kick, almost as good as sex.
You ought to try it.
I'll do some boxing.
Bullshit. You boxed once a month max, and mostly because you got a buzz out of smacking those snotty guys around. That's not the same as working out to feel good.
Salander shrugged.
Mimi sat straddling her. Lisbeth, you're so obsessed. You should know by now that I like having you in bed, not because of how you look, but because of the way you act. I think you're sexy as hell.
You too. That's why I kept coming back.
Not for love, Mimi said, pretending to be hurt.
Salander shook her head.
Are you seeing somebody?
Mimi hesitated a moment before she nodded.
Maybe.
In a way.
Possibly. It's a little complicated.
I'm not snooping.
I know, but I don't mind telling you. It's someone at the university who's a little older than me. She's been married 20 years, but her husband travels a lot, so we get together when he's not around.
Suburbs?
Villa?
All that?
She's a closet dyke. It's been going on since last autumn, and it's getting a bit boring. But she's really luscious. And then I hang out with the usual gang, of course.
I was just wondering whether I could come and see you again.
I'd really like to hear from you.
Even if I disappear for another 6 months?
Just keep in touch. I'd like to know if you're dead or alive. And in any case, I'll remember your birthday.
No strings?
Mimi sighed and smiled.
You know, you're a dyke I could imagine living with. You'd leave me alone when I wanted to be left alone.
Salander said nothing.
Apart from the fact that you're not really a dyke, you're probably bisexual. But most of all, you're sexual. You like sex, and you don't care about what gender. You're an entropic chaos factor.
I don't know what I am, Salander said, but I'm in Stockholm now and pretty bad at relationships. In fact, I don't know one single person here. You're the first person I've talked to since I got home.
Mimi studied her with a serious expression.
Do you really want to know people? You're the most secretive and unapproachable person I know. But your breasts really are luscious.
She put her fingers under one nipple and stretched the skin.
They fit you. Not too big and not too small.
Salander sighed with relief that the reviews were satisfactory.
And they feel real.
She squeezed the breast so hard that Salander gasped. They looked at each other. Then Mimi bent and gave Salander a deep kiss. Salander responded and threw her arms around Mimi. The coffee was left to get cold. Chapter 7 Saturday, January 29th to Sunday, February 13th. At around 11 on Saturday morning, a car drove into Svavelsjö between Järna and Vagenherred. The community consisted of no more than 15 buildings, and stopped in front of the last building about 500 feet outside the village proper. It was a tumble-down industrial structure that had once been a printing factory, but now had a sign over the main door identifying it as Svavelsjö Motorcycle Club. There was no other car in sight. Nevertheless, the driver looked around carefully before he got out of his car. He was huge and blonde. The air was cold. He put on brown leather gloves and took a black sports bag from the trunk. He was not worried about being observed. It would be impossible to park close to the old printing factory without being seen. If any police or government unit wanted to keep the building under surveillance, they would have to equip their people with camouflage and telescopes and dig them in at the far end of a field. Inevitably, that would be talked about by the villagers, and three of the houses were owned by Svavelsjö MC members. On the other hand, he did not want to go inside the building. The police had raided the clubhouse on several occasions, and no one could be sure whether or not bugging equipment had been hidden there. This meant that conversation inside was pretty much about cars, girls, and beer, and sometimes about which stocks were good to invest in. So the man waited until Carl Magnus Lundin came out to the yard. Magge Lundin was club president. He was tall, with a slim build, but over time he had acquired a hefty beer belly. He was only 36. He had dark blonde hair in a ponytail and wore black jeans, boots, and a heavy winter jacket. He had 5 counts on his police record. 2 of them were for minor drug offences, 1 for receiving stolen goods, and 1 for stealing a car and drunk driving. The 5th charge, the most serious, had sent him to prison for a year. It was for grievous bodily harm when, several years ago, he had gone berserk in a bar in Stockholm. Lundin and his huge visitor shook hands and walked slowly along the fence around the yard.
"It's been a few months," Lundin said.
The man said,
"We've got a deal going down. 3,060 grams of methamphetamine."
"Same terms as last time?"
50-50.
Lundin pulled a pack of cigarettes out of his breast pocket. He liked doing business with the giant. Meth brought a street price of between 160 and 230 kroner per gram, depending on availability. So 3,060 grams would yield a cut value of about 600,000 kroner. Svavelsjö MC would distribute the 3 kilos in batches of about 250 grams each to known dealers. At that stage, the price would drop to somewhere between 120 and 130 kroner per gram. It was an exceptionally attractive deal for Svavelsjö MC. Unlike deals with other suppliers, there was never any crap about advance payment or fixed prices. The blonde giant supplied the goods and demanded 50%, an entirely reasonable share of the revenue. They knew more or less what a kilo of meth would bring in. The exact amount depended on to what extent Lundin could get away with cutting the stuff. It could vary by a few thousand one way or the other, but when the deal was done, the giant would collect around 190,000 kroner. They had done a lot of business together over the years, always using the same system. Lundin knew that the giant could have doubled his take by handling the distribution himself. He also knew why the man accepted a lower profile. He could stay in the background and let Svavelsjö MC have all the risk. He made a smaller, but a safer income. And unlike with all other suppliers he had ever come across, it was a relationship that was based on sound business principles, credit and goodwill, no hassle, no bullshit, and no threats. The giant had also swallowed a loss of almost 100,000 kroner over a weapons delivery that went bust. Lundin knew no one else in the business who could absorb a loss like that. He was terrified when he'd had to tell him. Lundin explained how the deal had gone sour, and how a policeman at the Crime Prevention Centre might be about to make a big score off a member of the Aryan Brotherhood in Värmland. But the giant had not so much as raised an eyebrow. He was almost sympathetic. Shit happens. The whole delivery had to be written off. Lundin was not without talents. He understood that a smaller, less risky profit was good business. He had never once considered double-crossing the giant. That would be bad form. The giant and his associates settled for a lower profit so long as the accounting was honest. If he cheated the blonde, he would come calling, and Lundin was convinced that he would not survive such a visit.
"When can you deliver?"
The giant dropped his sports bag to the ground.
"Delivery has been made."
Lundin did not feel like opening the bag to check the contents. Instead, he reached out his hand as a sign that they had a deal and he intended to do his part.
"There's one more thing," the giant said.
"What's that?"
"We'd like to put a special job your way."
"Let's hear it."
He pulled an envelope out of his inside jacket pocket and gave it to Lundin, who opened it and took out a passport photograph and a sheet of A4 containing personal data. He raised his eyebrows inquiringly.
"Her name is Lisbeth Salander, and she lives in Stockholm, on Lundegarten, in Södermalm."
"Right."
"She's probably out of the country at present, but she'll turn up sooner or later."
"Okay."
"My employer would like to have a quiet talk with her. She has to be delivered alive. We suggest that warehouse near Ingern, and we need someone to clean up afterwards. She has to disappear without a trace."
"We shall be able to handle that. How will we know when she's home?"
"I'll tell you."
"And the price?"
"What do you say to 10,000 for the whole job? It's pretty straightforward. Drive to Stockholm, pick her up, deliver her to me."
They shook hands again. On her second visit to Lundergarten, Sallander flopped down on the lumpy sofa to think. She had to make a number of decisions, and one of these was whether or not she should keep the apartment. She lit a cigarette, blew smoke up towards the ceiling, and tapped the ash into an empty Coke can. She had no reason to love this apartment. She had moved in with her mother and her sister when she was 4. Her mother had slept in the living room, and she and Camilla shared the tiny bedroom. When she was 12 and all the evil happened, she was moved to a children's clinic, and then, when she was 15, to the first in a series of foster families. The apartment had been rented out by her trustee, Holger Palmgren, who had also seen to it that it was returned to her when she turned 18 and needed a place to live. The apartment had been a fixed point for almost all of her life. Although she no longer needed it, she did not like the idea of selling it. That would mean strangers in her space. The logistical problem was that all her mail, insofar as she received any at all, came to Lundergarten. If she got rid of the apartment, she would have to find another address to use. Sallander did not want to be an official entry in all the databases. In this regard, she was almost paranoid. She had no reason to trust the authorities, or anyone else, for that matter. She looked out at the firewall of the back courtyard as she had done her whole life. She was suddenly glad of her decision to leave the apartment. She had never felt safe there. Every time she turned onto Lundergarten and approached the street door, sober or not, she had been acutely aware of her surroundings, of parked cars and passers-by. She felt sure that somewhere out there were people who wished her harm, and they would most probably attack her as she came or went from the apartment. There had been no attack, but that did not mean that she could relax. The address on Lundergarten was on every public register and database, and in all those years she had never had the means to improve her security. She could only stay on her guard. Now the situation was different. She did not want anyone to know her new address in Musebacke. Instinct warned her to remain as anonymous as possible. But that did not solve the problem of what to do with the old apartment. She brooded about it for a while and then took out her mobile and called Mimi.
"Hi, it's me."
"Hi, Lisbeth.
So you want to make contact after only a week this time? I'm at Lundergarten."
"Okay."
"I was wondering if you'd like to take over the apartment."
"What do you mean?"
"You live in a shoebox."
"I like my shoebox. Are you moving?"
"It's empty here."
Mimi seemed to hesitate at the other end of the line.
"Lisbeth, I can't afford it. It's a housing association apartment, and it's all paid off. The rent is $1,480 a month, which must be less than you're paying for the shoebox. And the rent has been paid for a year."
"But are you thinking of selling it?
I mean, it must be worth quite a bit. About $1.5 million, if you can believe the estate agent's ads."
"I can't afford that."
"I'm not selling. You can move in here tonight. You can live here as long as you like, and you won't have to pay anything for a year. I'm not allowed to rent it out, but I can write you into my agreement as my roommate. That way you won't have any hassle with the housing association."
"But, Lisbeth, are you proposing to me?" Mimi laughed.
"I'm not using the apartment, and I don't want to sell it."
"You mean I could live there for free, girl?"
"Are you serious?"
"Yes. For how long?"
"As long as you like. Are you interested?"
"Of course I am. I don't get offered a free apartment in the middle of Surda every day of the week."
"There's a catch."
"I thought as much."
"You can live here as long as you like, but I'll still be listed as resident and I'll get my mail here. All you have to do is take in the mail and let me know if anything interesting turns up."
"Lisbeth, you're the freakiest.
Where are you going to live?"
"We'll talk about that later," Sallander said.
They agreed to meet that afternoon so that Mimi could have a proper look at the apartment. Sallander was already in a much better mood. She walked down to Handelsbanken on Hornsgarten, where she took a number and waited her turn. She showed her ID and explained that she had been abroad for some time and wanted to know the balance of her savings account. The sum was 82,670 kroner. The account had been dormant for more than a year, and one deposit of 9,312 kroner had been made the previous autumn. That was the inheritance from her mother. Sallander withdrew 9,312 kroner. She wanted to spend the money on something that would have made her mother happy. She walked to the post office on Rosenlundsgarten and sent an anonymous deposit to one of Stockholm's crisis centres for women. It was 8 on Friday evening when Berger shut down her computer and stretched. She had spent 9 hours solid putting the finishing touches on the March issue of Millennium, and since Erickson was working full-time on Svensson's themed issue, she had had to do a good part of the editing herself. Cortez and Karim had helped out, but they were primarily writers and researchers and not used to editing. So she was tired, and her back ached. But she was satisfied both with the day and with life in general. The accountant's graphs were pointing in the right direction. Articles were coming in on time, or at least not unmanageably late, and the staff was happy. After more than a year, they were still on a high from the adrenaline rush of the Venestrum affair. After trying for a while to massage her neck, Berger decided she needed a shower, and thought about using the one in the office bathroom. But she felt too lazy and put her feet up on the desk instead. She was going to turn 45 in 3 months, and that famous future she had longed for was starting to be a thing of the past. She had developed a network of tiny wrinkles and lines around her eyes and mouth, but she knew that she still looked good. She worked out at the gym twice a week, but she had noticed it was getting more difficult to climb the mast during her long sailing trips, and she was the one who always had to do the climbing. Her husband had terrible vertigo. Berger reflected that her first 45 years, despite a number of ups and downs, had been by and large successful. She had money, status, a home which gave her great pleasure, and a job she enjoyed. She had a tender-hearted husband who loved her, and with whom she was still in love after 15 years of marriage. And on the side she had a pleasant and seemingly inexhaustible lover, who might not satisfy her soul, but who did satisfy her body when she needed it. She smiled as she thought of Blomqvist. She wondered when he was going to come clean and tell her that he was sleeping with Harriet Wanger. Neither of them had breathed a word about their relationship, but Berger wasn't born yesterday. At the board meeting in August she had noticed a glance that passed between them. Out of sheer cussedness she had tried both of their mobile numbers later that evening, and both were turned off. That was hardly watertight evidence, of course, but after subsequent board meetings Blomqvist was always unavailable in the evening. It was almost comical to watch the way Wanger would leave after dinner with the same excuse, that she had to go to bed early. Berger did not pry, and she was not jealous. On the other hand, she would certainly tease them both about it at some suitable occasion. She never got involved in Blomqvist's affairs with other women, but she hoped that his affair with Wanger would not give rise to problems on the board. Yet she was not really worried. Blomqvist had all manner of terminated relationships behind him, and he was still on friendly terms with most of the women involved. Berger was incredibly happy to be Blomqvist's friend and confidant. In certain ways he was a fool, and in other ways so insightful that he seemed like an oracle. But he had never understood her love for her husband, had never been able to grasp why she considered Gregor Beckmann such an enchanting person. Warm, exciting, generous, and above all, without many of the traits that she so detested in most men. Beckmann was the man she wanted to grow old with. She had wanted to have children with him, but it had not been possible, and now it was too late. But in her choice of a life partner she could not imagine a better or more stable person, someone she could so completely and wholeheartedly trust, and who was always there for her when she needed him. Blomqvist was very different. He was a man with such shifting traits that he sometimes appeared to have multiple personalities. As a professional he was obstinate and almost pathologically focused on the job at hand. He took hold of a story and worked his way forward to the point where it approached perfection, and then he tied up all the loose ends. When he was at his best he was brilliant, and when he was not at his best he was still far better than the average. He seemed to have an almost intuitive gift for deciding which story was hiding a skeleton in the closet, and which story would turn into a dull, run-of-the-mill piece. She had never regretted working with him. Nor had she ever regretted becoming his lover. The only person who understood Berger's passion for sex with Blomqvist was her husband, and he understood it because she dared to discuss her needs with him. It was not a matter of infidelity, but of desire. Sex with Blomqvist gave her a kick that no other man was able to give her, including her husband. Sex was important to her. She had lost her virginity when she was 14, and spent a great part of her teenage years in a frustrated search for fulfillment. She had tried everything from heavy petting with classmates and an awkward affair with a teacher to phone sex and fetishism. She had experimented with most of what interested her in eroticism. She had toyed with bondage and been a member of Club Extreme, which arranged parties of a kind that were not socially acceptable. On several occasions, she had tried sex with other women and, disappointed, admitted that it simply was not her thing, and that women could not excite her even a fraction as much as a man could. Or two. With Beckman, she had explored sex with two men, one of them a famous gallery owner, and discovered both that her mate had a strong bisexual inclination, and that she herself was almost paralysed with pleasure at feeling two men simultaneously caressing and satisfying her, just as she experienced a sense of pleasure that was difficult to define when she watched her husband being caressed by another man. She and Beckman had repeated that excitement with the same success with a couple of regular partners. It was not that her sex life with her husband was boring or unsatisfying. It was just that Blomqvist gave her a completely different experience. He had talent. He was quite simply so good that it felt as if she had achieved the optimal balance with Beckman as husband and Blomqvist as lover when needed. She could not do without either of them, and she had no intention of choosing between them. And this was what her husband had understood, that she had a need beyond what he could offer her, even in the form of his most imaginative acrobatic exercises in the jacuzzi. What Berger liked best about her relationship with Blomqvist was the fact that he had no desire whatsoever to control her. He was not the least bit jealous, and even though she herself had had several attacks of jealousy when they first began to go out together 20 years ago, she had discovered that in his case she did not need to be jealous. Their relationship was built on friendship, and in matters of friendship he was boundlessly loyal. It was a relationship that would survive the harshest tests. But it bothered her that so many of her acquaintances still whispered about her relationship with Blomqvist, and always behind her back. Blomqvist was a man. He could go from bed to bed without anyone raising their eyebrows. She was a woman, and the fact that she had a lover, and with her husband's consent, coupled with the fact that she had also been true to her lover for 20 years, resulted in the most interesting dinner conversations. She thought for a moment and then picked up the phone to call her husband.
"Hi, darling. What are you doing?"
"Writing."
Beckman was not just an artist. He was, most of all, a professor of art history, and the author of several books. He often participated in public debate, and he acted as consultant to several large architecture firms. For the past year he'd been working on a book about the artistic decoration of buildings and its influence, and why people prospered in some buildings but not in others. The book had begun to develop into an attack on functionalism, which, Berger suspected, would cause a furrow.
"How's it going?"
"Good. It's flowing. How about you?"
"I just finished the latest issue. It's going to the printer on Thursday."
"Well done."
"I'm wiped out."
"It sounds like you've got something in mind."
"Have you planned anything for tonight? Would you be terribly upset if I didn't come home?"
"Say hello to Blomqvist, and tell him he's tempting fate," said Beckman.
"He might like that."
"Okay. Then tell him that you're a witch who's impossible to satisfy, and he'll end up aging prematurely."
"He knows that."
"In that case, all that's left for me is to commit suicide. I'm going to keep writing until I pass out. Have a good time."
Blomqvist was at Svensson and Johansson's place in Enschede, wrapping up a discussion about some details in Svensson's manuscript. She wondered if he was busy tonight, or would he consider giving a massage to an aching back.
"You got the keys?"
he said.
"Make yourself at home."
"I will. See you in an hour or so."
It took her 10 minutes to walk to Bellman's Garden. She undressed and showered and made espresso. Then she crawled into bed and waited naked and full of anticipation. The optimum gratification for her would probably be a threesome with her husband and Blomqvist, but that would never happen. Blomqvist was so straight that she liked to tease him about being a homophobe. He had zero interest in men. Apparently, you could not get everything you wanted in this world. The blond giant frowned in irritation as he manoeuvred the car at 10 miles an hour along a forest road in such bad repair that for a while he thought he must have taken a wrong turn.
It was just beginning to get dark when the road finally widened, and he caught sight of the cabin. He stopped, turned off the engine, and took a look around. He had about 50 yards to go. He was in the region of Stallarholmen, not far from the town of Mariefred. It was a simple 1950s cabin in the middle of the woods. Through a line of trees he could see a